The headlines this hour. Yemeni officials say Saudi Arabia has seized yet another fuel ship heading for the country's Hodeidah port, despite having UN clearance. The Iraqi president praises Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated by the United States for standing by the people of Iraq against terrorists. Protests over energy price hikes continue in Kazakhstan, despite the government's resignation and the decision to reinstate price caps. Well, welcome to the studios near the capital, Tehran. This is Mias. Thanks for joining us. The Yemen Petroleum Company says the Saudi-led coalition has seized yet another fuel ship heading for the country's Hodeidah port. The company says this is the fifth fuel ship that has been detained by the coalition, despite having UN clearance to enter Yemeni ports. Riyadh has not yet commented on the seizure of the Yemeni-bound ship. Hodeidah is a key entry point for much-needed aid supplies to Yemen. Saudi Arabia, that waged a war on Yemen in 2015, has also imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen, disrupting the flow of vital goods like food, fuel, and medicine. The blockade has caused a severe fuel crisis, disrupting essential health services. The seizure of the vessel comes just days after Yemeni forces captured a UAE-flagged cargo ship in the Red Sea. The footage later released showed the ship was laden with military equipment and vehicles. Earlier, we were joined by activist and political commentator Hossein Abu-Ghaiti. He says the United Nations is well aware about the seizure of Yemen-bound fuel ships by the Saudi-led coalition, but the world body remains silent.
Saudi coalition has been doing this from the beginning of the war. A year ago, there was about 11 or 12 ships were seized by Saudi Arabia. And this is exactly what the Saudi have done, is show you the difference between Yemeni army and between the Saudi coalition. Yemeni army has seized a ship that was carrying weapons that are used to kill Yemeni civilians. I mean, they have not seized a civilian ship or a commercial ship. And Saudi, what they do, they actually keep seizing those fuel ships, even though the United Nations has given the green light and has searched those ships. And now, if the United Nations actually want to help Yemen, they should condemn the Saudi, and they should announce and tell the world who's actually seizing those ships and why, and they should explain that to the international community. Because, as you know, that everything in any country depends on fuel, hospitals, electricity, water supplies, and everything. I mean, if you have no fuel, this means you're going to shut down everything. But I think that this latest step, it has been done actually by a green light from Biden administration. Just since Biden has sworn as a United States president, we have seen the longest shortage and fuel crisis in Yemen.
The Iraqi president hails Iran's national hero, the late Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, for his valuable contributions to the uprooting of terrorists in the region. Ayam Saleh says General Soleimani stood up for the people of Iraq when they were being brutally victimized by Daesh terrorists. Earlier today, Saleh and several high-profile current and former Iraqi officials attended an event in Baghdad to honor General Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Iraq's Defense Minister Juma Inad also addressed the event. He said the two personalities had the most pivotal role in the fight against Daesh. Both commanders lost their lives in the U.S. drone strike near Baghdad 2 years ago. Iran's capital, Tehran, has hosted pundits and officials from across the world to discuss the dimensions of the U.S. assassination of Iranian military commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Yusuf Jalali has more.
Political experts and academics from 20 countries are here to discuss the character of a man who is known as the nemesis of the terrorists, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. General Soleimani was the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He was assassinated in January 2020 in a U.S. drone strike outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-U.S. President Donald Trump.
When we talk about Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, we're talking about a military commander who tasked himself with helping humanity, no matter if they were Christian, Azeris, or Sunni Muslims. That's what made him a revered figure who is loved by the people in the region, and millions took part in his funeral to pay homage to him.
So Qasem Soleimani is a human without a border. He's not an Iranian. He is for everybody because he helped Iranians, Syrians, Palestine, and so on and so forth. So when we talk of a hero, Qasem Soleimani is a real hero.
Soleimani is well known for dislodging Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also spearheaded major operations in Syria that resulted in liberating key areas from Daesh. Observers say, by assassinating General Soleimani, the U.S. tried to resurrect the terrorists. However, they call it a miscalculation that backfired in Washington, triggering the beginning of its exit from the region.
The previous administration of President Trump has explicitly announced their responsibility for this crime. President Trump, he said that, I ordered to kill General Soleimani. Now, this hegemonic attitude has to be stopped. They have to leave us. They are the direct reason, the Zionist American access, the direct reason for the destability and lack of security in the region and internationally. They have to be pushed out.
The Islamic Republic now calls General Soleimani a martyr and hails him as a national hero. It says it is working closely with Iraq to prosecute those behind Soleimani's assassination and will not stop until all perpetrators, including Donald Trump, face justice.
These people say the world owes General Soleimani a big thank you for his role in eradicating Daesh, since the terror group was trying to extend its activities throughout the world. They say the United States made a big mistake by assassinating General Soleimani, since it led everyone to a safe interpretation that Washington must be on the terrorist team. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinian prisoner Hisham Abu Hawash is suspending his hunger strike after 140 days, following an agreement by Israel to release him. His hunger strike, which is one of the longest ever, brings to the fore the years-long challenges of many Palestinians that are held captive in Israeli jails for undisclosed allegations.
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days. But he's finally breaking his fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had a especially tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawash prevails after 141 days of hunger strike. We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people, and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity, thanks to countries that press Israel to release him next month on February 26.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawash, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
Activist Mick Napier says Israel's decision to finally release Hisham Abu Hawash shows that the regime is afraid of the consequences of hunger strikes and similar acts of resistance.
But in this situation, I think the important question is, why would Israel reach a deal with a man who was dying, was weak, could hardly speak, could hardly hear, after 140 days on hunger strike? Israel's afraid of these situations. But more than that, Israel knows that it's deeply unpopular internationally, and something like this could shine a light on their whole system. It's a remarkable moment. The lesson we take from this is that Israel can be defeated. And Hisham Abu Hawash is a tremendous example, a tremendous inspiration to all those fighting for justice.
Developing at this hour in Kazakhstan, ongoing unrest over an energy price hike is far from over, even after protests resulted in the resignation of the government. The protesters have set fire to the mayor's office and stormed other political offices in Almaty. Similar protests are also taking place in other provinces. The Kazakh president says that he will act as tough as possible on those who break the law. He has already ordered to reinstate energy price caps, but that has failed to appease the people on the streets. The unrest started on Sunday after the government almost doubled fuel prices. More than 200 protesters have been detained so far. Russia has also reacted to the unrest, warning against any outside interference in the Central Asian nation. More than 500,000 people have signed a petition for former British Prime Minister Tony Blair to be stripped of knighthood, an appointment that was personally made by the country's monarch just last week. Petitioners say that the former premier should be tried and jailed for his role in the illegal invasion of Iraq in 2003. Saeed Puriza has this report from London.
Britain's highest rank for chivalry, awarded by Queen Elizabeth to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, a man described by campaigners as one of the most repugnant political figures in the world, in power from 1997 to 2007.
The backlash to the announcement has been immense and is only growing. Furious Iraq War veterans are now calling for the honor system to be overhauled. And more than 500,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Queen to strip the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons.
For millions of people in this country, it's an absolute insult, as it is to the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and various other places where we've now seen the war on terror over the last 20 years. And I don't see any justification for it whatsoever. I think that Blair never conceded that he was wrong about any of these things. The Chilcot inquiry, which was very, very critical of him, he immediately held a very long press conference afterwards and said he would do exactly the same again.
In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending U.S.-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone, and we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. Two decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague, and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saeed Puriza, London.
Tensions between the West and Russia over Ukraine continue to spiral up. The European Union once again warns Moscow of massive consequences and heavy costs in case of an attack on Ukraine. The bloc's top diplomat currently on a visit to Kiev. says the conflict in eastern Ukraine is escalating and jeopardizing European security as a whole. Joseph Borrell says the EU fully supports Ukraine's independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity. Borrell says that Brussels is working with the U.S.-led NATO military to de-escalate tensions. Recently, the West repeatedly accused Russia of preparing an invasion of Ukraine, citing Moscow's troop buildup along the border. The Kremlin, however, rejects the allegations and says that its military activities are merely aimed at defensive purposes. It has also accused NATO of causing regional tensions with eastward expansion. The French president is under fire over his offensive comments about those refusing to get vaccinated for COVID-19. Emmanuel Macron's right-wing rival in the upcoming presidential election accuses him of insulting the unvaccinated citizens.
I was outraged by the president's comments. I was outraged by his comments because that was not all he said. He also meant that the unvaccinated are not citizens. And it's not up to the president to pick and choose who among the French are good or bad. They have to be accepted as they are, and they should be governed and united without being insulted.
Other political leaders have also denounced Macron. Far-right candidate Marine Le Pen accuses him of wanting to make some French, quote, second-class citizens. That after Macron said that he would make life difficult for those who have not received COVID jabs yet. The word he used in his comments is regarded inappropriate in French language. Controversy has prompted Parliament to suspend a bill proposed on COVID-related rules. Macron has been seeking legislation that will make it mandatory for people to show proof of vaccination for entering public places. Macron's presidency will come to an end this year. Some analysts are doubtful that he could win another term. Tensions run high over North Korea's latest missile launch, with Washington strongly condemning Pyongyang's move. The U.S. State Department says the launch violates multiple U.N. Security Council resolutions and poses a threat to the international community and the neighbors of North Korea. Washington is calling for dialogue, while also underscoring its commitment to the security of Japan and South Korea, countries which are on hostile terms with Pyongyang. South Korean President Moon Jae-in is also insisting that he will not give up hope for dialogue with the North. Meanwhile, China is calling for caution. On Tuesday, Japan and South Korea reported that North Korea had fired an unidentified projectile, the first such launch by Pyongyang in the new year. Tokyo said that it could be a ballistic missile. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said that the projectile was fired into the sea east of the Korean Peninsula. The details are so far sketchy. It has been only days since North Korean leader Kim Jong-un pledged to continue developing his nation's military to counter an unstable international situation. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Currently, the U.S. is pursuing a nuclear weapons modernization program that was launched by the Obama-Biden administration that is expected to cost at least $1.7 trillion by 2046. This includes large spending increases on a controversial low-yield smaller nuclear warhead, the total replacement of the Intercontinental Ballistic Missile Force, new B-21 strategic bombers, B-52 upgrades, more destructive nuclear warheads, as well as other programs. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by John Letman, writer. This article is published under the heading, 1 year in, Biden's nuclear policies look a lot like Trump's. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please.
The
When Biden became president 1 year ago, he inherited international challenges. Vowing to rejoin the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, better known as the Iran nuclear deal, from which Trump unilaterally withdrew in 2018, Biden said the U.S. was prepared to return to full compliance if Iran does the same. Sal Rod, a senior research fellow with National Iranian American Council, told Truthout that despite high hopes that Biden would reverse Trump's actions, which helped drive the U.S. and Iran close to all-out war in 2019 to 2020, in many ways, Biden administration has continued the Trump administration's maximum pressure policy. The continuation of sanctions, Rod says, has only hindered efforts to revive the deal. After whiplash diplomacy in which Trump threatened to totally destroy North Korea, only to later fawn over beautiful letters he received from Kim Jong-un, Northeast Asia analysts were hopeful the Biden administration would lead to a less erratic, more substantive phase of nuclear diplomacy. Although Biden said he shares South Korean President Moon Jae-in's stated goal of complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, Christine Ahn, executive director of Women Cross DMZ, told her thought, much of this is rhetoric, and the Biden administration has not changed what she called the failed policies of sanctions, military exercises, and the travel ban. The U.S. will continue these militaristic policies until North Korea makes progress on denuclearization, which won't happen as long as the U.S. continues its hostile policies, Ahn said. She gives Biden a grade of D because he hasn't done anything to improve relations with North Korea, including declaring an end to the Korean War, which will be pivotal to advance denuclearization. Arms Control Association Executive Director Daryl G. Kimball told Truthout that Biden's first year of nuclear policy has been a mix of good, including New Start, and bad, including an enormous nuclear budget, and incomplete or mixed, including the issue of North Korea. Kimball said it's not a simple answer that can be boiled down to a letter grade. In July, the association published an issue brief, which details why Biden's 2022 nuclear budget is very unhelpful. What Kimball described as an excessive and extremely costly plan to upgrade all major aspects of the nuclear weapons arsenal. Exactly what the role and purpose of nuclear weapons is in Biden's national security strategy will be detailed in the forthcoming nuclear posture review expected in early 2022. Kimball said the jury is still out on whether the president will follow through on his pledge during the campaign and in his interim national security strategy to reduce the role of nuclear weapons and to restore U.S. leadership on nuclear arms control and disarmament. I have my deep concerns about whether this nuclear posture review will do that. The one area where Kimball gives Biden an F is for his failure to speak about the importance of reducing growing nuclear competition and the need to pursue a world without nuclear weapons. Kimball said, I think it's a failure of leadership in his first 12 months not to have delivered a major or even a minor policy speech at the subject. If Biden chooses to do so, he can change that when the review conference of the parties to the treaty on the non-proliferation of nuclear weapons commences in New York on January 4th. One of the most notable nuclear developments of Biden's first year in office occurred just 2 days after he was sworn in as president. On January 22nd, the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, TPNW, entered into force, making nuclear weapons illegal under international law. Adopted and ratified by at least 58 countries, the U.S. and other 8 nuclear weapons-possessing nations opposed the ban. As Arms Control Association's Kim Ball points out, the TPNW contributes to a common goal shared by nuclear-armed states and non-nuclear-armed states, which is the pursuit of a world without nuclear weapons. The TPNW also reinforces the taboo against the possession and use of nuclear weapons. Beatrice Finn, executive director of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, notes that when Biden took office, he inherited a disarmament situation that was in tatters, but he says the TPNW created a bright spot. Instead of embracing this, the Biden administration has increasingly and aggressively attacked the TPNW and relentlessly pressured allies to abandon the treaty. Biden's disarmament policy, Finn told Truthout, is a D-minus, not the leadership that can save Americans from nuclear disaster.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
We've been discussing the effect of the Shahada of the Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha and her choice to be a Shahida. If the followers of the Ahlul Bayt choose their Shahada, which they do, I personally have come across multiple accounts that the Shaheed knew that going today means Shahada. It will happen. They were told beforehand and they chose that. They went there, they became Shuhada. Regarding Hajj Qasim, this has been mentioned, Hajj Abu Mahdi, and multiple other accounts that we have come across. These are students of the Ahlul Bayt, followers of the Ahlul Bayt. It wasn't only Sayyid al-Shuhada, Imam al-Husayn salamullah alayhi, that chose his martyrdom. Fatima al-Zahra chose her martyrdom. She knew standing behind that door is going to lead to her martyrdom. She knew standing for Ali will lead to her martyrdom. She chose Shahada. It was a choice she made. Not that she made a choice that inevitably would lead to that. She didn't want the inevitable effect of the death and the killing of her, but rather she only wanted to stand. If it happens, it happens. This is the way we deal with things. People that are not even similar to those followers of the Ahlul Bayt that chose Shahada, people like us, we say, okay, we're going to stand up against tyranny, stand against these zalimeen, and yeah, it may happen. Some of us may get killed in that way, and that's Shahada, and we welcome that. But that's for someone below average or average like myself, below average like myself, or average like above myself. For someone who's reached even the rank of being a follower, a true follower of the Ahlul Bayt, they don't only do those things that maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't happen. Yes, those are the initial stages. Eventually, the person ascends where they know when and where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants them to be a shaheed, they choose that shahada particularly in that way. Fatimah al-Zahra salamullah alayha chose that shahada. Therefore, we're talking about what she did with her shahada, with her choice. We talked about the effect of shahada on the mu'mineen on the first night and how it is important for us to note that and to see the effect of the martyrdom of Fatimah al-Zahra salamullahi alayha on the believers and them wanting shahada. When we talked about the effect of shahada, which is the instrument through which the choice they make to kill a mu'min, a mu'minah, like Fatimah al-Zahra salamullahi alayha above all, and anyone who follows her footsteps, killing that mu'min or mu'mina simply because they chose to stand firm on the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that will be the instrument through which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will bring down that tyrant. We talked about this last night, so it's a form of warfare in this war with the enemies of Islam. Shahada, seeking it generally as an average believer and hopefully ascending with this, doing whatever it takes, and then when we are told that this is the moment that God wants you to be a shaheed, we say labbaik Allahumma labbaik, we want that shahada, I will be a shaheed on that, in that moment, and I'll prepare for it and I'll go. Hajj Qasim prepared for this. I don't know if you've seen that clip that has been released. Said Hassan mentioned this. Others, he had mentioned it a year ago as well, but there's a recent clip that's out. I encourage everyone to see that. He said every time Hajj Qasim used to come, there was work that he had to do. Never came just casually, just to see. This last time, he said he came, then he said he's coming, so we were expecting he's going to come. We prayed and so on and so on. I was waiting for him to say why he's here and what we need to discuss, what has happened, what decision needs to be made. After the prayer and so on, he said, I'm just here to visit. I'm just here to visit. It's evident that he knew. And then there's another conversation, another clip, some of the Iranian commanders that were there in Lebanon over there. They said Hajj Imad Mughniyah's daughter, that Hajj Qasim took very good care of after the Shahada of Hajj Imad Mughniyah. They said, we overheard a conversation that Hajj Qasim had with the daughter of Hajj Imad. And in that conversation, the phone conversation, he said, we thought we heard he said, we didn't hear the question, but it seemed like the question was, so where are you going after this? And they said, we thought we heard it, but then we told ourselves, no, that probably misheard. He said, I'm going to my maqtal, to where I'm going to be killed. He said, we thought we misheard, but then we realized, no, we didn't mishear. That was the case. That's what he said. He knew. He knew. Choosing that shahada is choosing the greatest, most effective tool against tyrants. That choice of shahada that a believer makes, and the choice on the other side that the tyrant makes to take the life of that shaheed, is the doom of that tyrant. If you're looking for ways of bringing down tyranny, shahada is the most effective way. In fact, we have in some of the narrations what will be the last thing that will happen before the imam comes, which the coming of the imam is equivalent to the destruction of all tyranny and the removal of all tyrants. The last thing that will happen is the shahada of an-nafs az-zakiyah, some nafs that God has purified, will be taken by the hands of the global tyrants. They will martyr him or her, whoever it is, an-nafs az-zakiyah. They will martyr that person, and when that person is martyred, the imam of our time comes. These are trends we see in our teachings. Shahada is a great tool, the strongest warfare. Guns aren't good forms of warfare. Swords aren't. They don't guarantee the defeat of the enemies of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Shahada does. It was the Shahada of Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha that guaranteed the defeat of the movement against the Ahlul Bayt. Let me clarify this before continuing on the topic. We need to correct a little bit of our understanding of what happened. We think wrongly that Amir al-Mu'mineen, Fatima al-Zahra were defeated in that scene. No, they weren't defeated. Amir al-Mu'mineen didn't officially rule as he was said, he was told, or the people were told that your ruler should be Ali ibn Abi Talib. That didn't happen. Now, that doesn't mean the defeat of Ali ibn Abi Talib. Ali ibn Abi Talib was not defeated. The enemies of Islam, Iblis, and all those who he lined up to deviate Islam after the demise of the Prophet, by the will of God, because of the Shahada of Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha, they were defeated. Their version of Islam is not found today, brothers and sisters. That Islam, that if that would have continued similar to Christianity, that there is no correct version of Christianity today. There is no Christianity available. Nowhere in the world is the original Christianity of Christ himself. You can't find it anywhere. The defeat of the Ahlul Bayt would have been something like that. Of course, for another time, just to make this clear, Jesus, salamullah alayhi, this great prophet of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he wasn't defeated either. Because his religion was not supposed to remain as such. That religion went to the time of the Prophet, and the true believers in Christ did join Islam at that time. They did. And so Christianity, true Christianity, lives within Islam. Therefore, Christ is not deviated. But we're using this, that those particular teachings that were supposed to be handed over to the Prophet, and whoever followed those particular teachings should have followed the Prophet. Those who didn't ended up with something that was not what Christ had brought. It was not Christianity. Islam should have ended up something like that if the Ahlul Bayt would have been defeated. If the movement of Islam would have been defeated. If the Shahada of Fatima al-Zahra was in there. The Shahada of Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha, is what caused Islam to live, to grow, to come out of the dark, to revive the Islam of the Prophet 1400 years later. It's because of the Shahada of the Lady Fatima al-Zahra. لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء فاطم الزهراء
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Around 4 million homes in the United Kingdom were already classed as fuel poor before a surge in global energy market prices triggered one of the steepest ever energy bill hikes in October. But campaigners are braced for a record increase in the numbers unable to pay their energy bills following another price hike this spring. We're prepared for you an article written by Gillian Ambrose. The piece is titled Charity Warns 6 Million UK Homes May Be Unable to Pay Energy Bills After Price Hike. According to a fuel poverty charity, the number of UK households living in fuel poverty could climb to the highest level on record by this spring, unless the government moves to soften the blow of a looming record high energy bill hike. Around 4 million homes in the United Kingdom were already classed as fuel poor before a surge in global energy market prices triggered one of the steepest ever energy bill hikes in October. But campaigners are braced for a record increase in the numbers unable to pay their energy bills following another price hike this spring. The charity National Energy Action warned that the double blow to household bills could cause at least 2 million more homes to slip into fuel poverty compared with the start of 2021, taking the total to 6 million households. This would be the highest level of fuel poverty across the United Kingdom since records began in 1996. The looming energy price hike has not yet been finalised by the regulator, but Adam Scorer, chief executive of National Energy Action, told The Observer that the number of households in fuel poverty would skyrocket in April. This is expected to deepen the UK's national energy crisis and compound the year of the squeeze, predicted by the Resolution Foundation recently, which threatens to trigger a cost-of-living catastrophe for hard-pressed families. Households are already paying record prices to put petrol in their cars and can expect the cost of consumer goods to rocket as fuel prices and supply chain disruptions take their toll on major companies. Adam Scorer, chief executive of National Energy Action, said, "Those on lowest incomes and in less efficient homes will not just face financial hardship, but intolerable living conditions, ill health, and for too many, a shortened life." He added, "This is not just a conjecture, it will happen, and we've had enough time to see it coming and act." Energy market prices climbed steadily over 2021 before leaping to record highs in October and fresh record highs in December. The market rally has fueled one of the steepest energy price hikes in the history of the United Kingdom's liberalised energy market. Ed Miliband, Shadow Secretary of State for Climate Change and Net Zero, said, "Working people are being hit by a cost of living crisis which has seen energy bills soar, food costs increase, and the weekly budget stretched. The government must take urgent action to support those people struggling to pay bills." Senior officials from the Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, the Treasury and No. 10 Downing Street have already met with industry regulator Ofgem and executives from the UK's biggest energy suppliers in recent weeks to thrash out a plan to avert the looming national energy crisis. No measures have so far been agreed, and further meetings are scheduled in the coming days. According to industry experts, the government's energy price cap could allow the average energy bill to rocket further to almost £2,000 a year when it is reset in April, from £1,138 in the previous year. To help cover the cost of dozens of failed energy suppliers. Ed Miliband, Shadow Secretary of State for Climate Change, said Labour has called for a value-added tax, VAT, on energy bills to be cut as a first step to help every household this winter. And the party would also ramp up ambition with our plan to retrofit 19 million homes to make them more energy efficient and help bring down household bills. Miliband added, "It is a moral and social scandal that fuel poverty exists in modern Britain, but with national leadership, we can beat it and ensure everyone has the warm, secure home that they deserve." A government spokesperson claimed protecting consumers was its top priority, which is why it was keeping in place the energy price cap, alongside schemes such as the £500 million Household Support Fund, the Warm Home Discount, winter fuel payments for over 65s, and cold weather payments. Meanwhile, several Conservative politicians have written to Prime Minister Boris Johnson urging him to scrap taxes on rapidly rising energy bills. About 20 Tory MPs and peers have written in the Sunday Telegraph asking for help for consumers facing fuel poverty, including Craig McKinlay, chair of the Net Zero Scrutiny Group of Conservative MPs, former Work and Pensions Secretary Esther McVeigh, and MPs Robert Halfen and Steve Baker. They argue that high energy prices are felt more painfully by the lowest paid and suggest that value-added tax or VAT on energy bills and environmental levies which fund renewable energy schemes. Moreover, according to a report, almost 5 million families in social housing in England are facing the biggest rent hike for a decade from April amid a mounting cost of living squeeze. The Resolution Foundation think tank said 4.75 million families would see rent on their local authority or housing association home rise by up to 4.1%, adding to the pressure on living costs by an average of £202 extra a year. It warned the increase would coincide with significant tax rises planned by the government to come in from April and a further jump in household utility bills when Ofgem's consumer energy price cap is raised. The Bank of England also forecasts inflation will peak at about 6% in the same month, April, the highest level since 1992. It added, rising social rents on top of these increases will be very damaging for living standards indeed. Social housing providers set rents each year within a cap calculated on the Consumer Price Index measure of inflation for September plus 1%. While this is a cap rather than a requirement, most providers are expected to raise rents by the full amount. It comes after the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, reached 3.1% in September. The latest rise follows a decade of housing costs rising faster than incomes for those living in social accommodation, with families renting from local authorities and other providers suffering a faster increase than those in private rented homes or those who own their property. According to the report, social renters now spend 19% of their income on housing costs, after housing benefit is taken into consideration, up from 15% a decade ago, equivalent to an extra £768 per year for the average family. In contrast, the share of income for private renters has remained flat over the same period, at an elevated level of 31%. Housing costs for homeowners have fallen from about 10% to 9% thanks to a drop in interest rates over the past decade. housing benefits paid by the government will help cushion the blow for some social renters, although the think tank warned the proportion of people receiving support from the state had dropped in recent years amid rising employment levels. Almost half of social renters do not receive housing benefit, meaning they will need to cover the biggest increase in social rent costs for a decade by themselves from the month of April. Lindsay Judge, research director at the Resolution Foundation, said the rise would put particular pressure on the 2 million social renters who don't receive housing benefit, but who are likely to face falling real wages, rising taxes, and soaring energy bills. Lindsay Judge added, while government support has purportedly helped to limit rent arrears from building up among social renters so far, raising rents to the maximum uprating would be unwise given the cost of living crunch hitting families hard recently. Have just listened to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to RIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on December 12, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in meeting with a number of nurses and the families of those martyred while working in the health profession.
Another value of nursing lies in the fact that nursing is a source of surety. Whose surety? First, that of the patient. When a nurse is watching over a patient, he feels assured. Secondly, his family feels assured since there is a nurse in the hospital who is with their patient. If there were no nurses, they would feel anxious and worried. And thirdly, everyone feels assured. Everyone's conscience is bothered, and people are worried about the pain and suffering of the people who are suffering. If we see there is no one attending to the need of a patient who is in pain and who is hungry and thirsty, our consciousness will naturally be bothered. But because we know there is a nurse there, we feel assured. So nurses are a source of surety for the patient, for the family members, and for everyone else, since nurses soothe our troubled consciousness. Therefore, on this basis, not only the patients indebted to the nurses' community, but you and I are also indebted to them and other people who are not related to the patient in any way, and are also indebted to them because nurses give everyone a feeling of assurance.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One reason why nursing in Islamic Iran is more valuable is that the arrogant powers in the world takes delight in the suffering of the Iranian nation. You don't believe this? The enemies rejoice at the suffering of the Iranian nation. What is the reason for saying this? The reason is the chemical bombing during the sacred defense. Thousands of our youth were afflicted with acute, painful, incurable diseases as a result of the chemical bombings. Sometimes their family members and their children were affected as well. Of course, the chemical bombings were carried out at Saddam's command, but who gave him the bombs? Who gave him the chemical substances? Who gave him the go-ahead, and who watched this happen with satisfaction? Just the mere possibility that a country may possess a chemical weapon causes a huge uproar in the world today. But he used to drop chemical bombs in the front of everyone's eyes.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh,
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.